Hello, Denim Heads, and welcome to your 13th Hangout with the Sons of Selvage podcast. We're a group of friends that get together to talk about denim, menswear, and related interests. We aim for this to be a fun and inclusive podcast where you feel like you're hanging out with longtime friends, but be warned, there's a bit of banter, cutting up, and explicit language. So in this episode, we'll do a bit of current interest and hobbies. Then we'll go into the news, a bit of Q&A, and our discussion topic today is our scene in the future. So talking a bit about what the raw denim boots and rugged style hobby might be like 10 or 20, even 50 years in the future. So I guess...
I feel like you needed like a little bit of reverb there. Future, future, future.
if you can edit that in, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
I've got GarageBand, so if you find a way to do that in GarageBand, please tell me. As always, please rate and review us wherever you listen to your podcast. Also, please follow us on Instagram at Sons of Selvage Podcast. Lastly, please message us on Instagram with any questions you'd like us to discuss on a future episode. And reach out to us if you'd like to join in on our Discord channel. On that note, let's do a quick round of intros. Andy's not with us today, but this is David.
This is Ilya.
This is Kevin.
This is Lex.
And I'm Tom.
Cool. So I guess to kick things off, I'll kick it off with the first current interest. I've been kind of getting big into the indie video games as of recent, and wanted to talk about two games in particular. So the first one is a game called Axiom Verge and Axiom Verge number 2. Pretty cool game. It's they're all developed by a single guy. I think his name is Thomas Kapp. And if anyone's ever played kind of the old school Metroid or Castlevania style games, really cool. This guy pretty much like all by himself developed this really amazing Metroid style video game. Both games have like a bunch of like really cool kind of mythos and lore around them, and kind of classic Metroid style goodness where you're getting crazy weapons and getting crazy power-ups and stuff, and like unlocking new parts of the map and, you know, exploring and whatnot. Really, really, really cool games. And also super impressive just because they were both developed by one person, but have two very different takes on the genre. So the first one's kind of a lot more just like run around and shooting stuff, and the second one's a lot more about just kind of world exploration. And then lastly, they're really cool because they've got this kind of like thread of story that weaves between the two of them, even though the plots are like completely different. They've got lots of like great kind of, you know, 80s/early 90s style computer graphics and kind of chiptune style music and stuff. So definitely check out both of the Axiom Verge games. I personally prefer the second one because it's a bit more kind of polished and kind of clean. And you can actually play them separately, the stories don't follow one another, so you could play two, and if you like it, play one later. And the other game, I just started playing it this weekend, is called Eastward, and that's kind of like a Legend of Zelda style game, but it's basically a post-apocalyptic world, and in it this guy who's a miner like finds this this little girl and kind of raises her. And for what it's worth, the guy actually looks like he's got kind of like rugged style, all like kitted out in Filson type kit for his little pixelated character. And you're kind of, I guess, avoiding some kind of evil force in the post-apocalypse.
Are his genes Selvage, though?
Good question, actually. Let me do a quick
That's the only way we rate people.
I'm guessing he's got a pretty mean turn up. Let me see here. Well, it looks like he's got some like pretty serious boots, maybe like a puffy vest, maybe like a Filson cruiser and a Filson pack. So I'm guessing he's probably got Filson denim on, and I'm not sure if those are going to be Selvage. I'm guessing 50-50 chance. But yeah, super cool. You're basically like traveling from somewhere where they start in this underground post-apocalyptic world, and you're heading eastward to some other kind of world, and it's got kind of all those like Legend of Zelda vibes. And there's a game called Earthbound, which is like a science fiction RPG back in the 90s or 80s. I can't remember. And it's got some kind of like influence from that as well. So two really cool indie games Axiom Verge, I think, is on any platform, and Eastward is just on Steam or Switch.
You played them on Switch, or what are you playing them on?
Yeah. Basically, my two consoles are, I've still got a PS4 that I bought when I moved to the UK, and then mm-hmm. I've got a Switch. So usually I'll buy a game on Switch if I'm able to, and if not, I'll play it on PS4.
Yeah, cool. Talking about video games, I know a couple of episodes ago you mentioned Horizon Zero Dawn. Pretty good game, as you said, which was free to download a little while ago on the PlayStation Store. And I don't know if it still is, but if any listeners want a new game to play, I picked that up a couple of months ago or downloaded it for free. And since we're in lockdown, I actually had a week off last week. I finished Ghost of Tsushima, so I had, you know, this waiting for me. So I started Horizon Zero Dawn last week, which, very good game. I was quite, because I didn't know who developed it or anything, but it's developed by Guerrilla Games, which is a Dutch developers. So it was quite funny at the start, kind of like a movie intro with like all the names of the people who worked on the game, and it was like Dutch name after Dutch name. I'm like, oh, you know, for some reason, it always, like, because we're such a small country with not a lot of people, it's always nice to see Dutch names on a big screen. So, but yeah, it's been very good so far. It's really interesting.
Did you have like a cousin working on it or something?
not that I know of, but but it's very good.
Yeah, they're a really good studio. I used to play their Killzone games, which were like really good shooters, and I think that's pretty much how they started, and then they were like, oh, mm-hmm. we're gonna make something completely different, and they did make something completely different.
Yeah, it's such a dope game. It's like really, really hard when you first start, because it's like the monsters just kick your ass, and then you eventually kind of the robots, but eventually you kind of figure out some tricks to like kill each model, and as you power up and stuff, it gets a bit easier. But yeah, I think throughout the whole campaign, like, it never gets boring. The story is always good as well. And then you're always fighting like bigger and crazier dinosaur monsters. And then they've actually also announced a sequel as well called Horizon Forbidden West.
Yeah.
And it's really cool because they're going to do it on PS4 and PS5. So you're not forced to have a PS5 to play it.
That's sweet. Yeah. The only thing I'm like, I always wonder how other people play this, right? Because it's kind of like an open play game, right? There's not really any linear thing. There's multiple quests that are happening at the same time. Even like, because if you look at Ghost of Tsushima, there's a main quest that you follow, and then there's multiple side quests that you do. But there's always only one main quest really that's happening. But with this one, there's multiple main things happening at the same time as well, if you choose to. So that's quite interesting. But and I'm kind of like, I usually just power through the main story, and then if I still feel like it, do all the side quests as well. Especially now that I'm a little bit further up the map, it's quite hard to like go all the way back down and do a couple of side quests there. So yeah, I always ask myself like how other people play it.
I struggle with those kind of things, because if it's too open, it's like sometimes it's a little bit overwhelming.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, and I usually try and stick with the main story, but it's very, like you say, it's very easy to get pulled aside to some mission, and you know, and then you forget where you actually were and what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I quite like the way Ghost of Tsushima is laid out, because like you say, it's got the main story, and then you can do what you want on the side, but you kind of almost go back to the main story all the time, because it's there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, on Zero Dawn, it definitely has a couple kind of disparate plot lines, but they do eventually kind of tie together into one main plot line, sort of like Tsushima. Mm-hmm. The most important thing to do is you can buy a piece of kit called the Golden Fast Travel Pack.
Yeah.
And it lets you quickly hop across the map once you get the right stuff for it and you buy it
from
a trader.
That's a good thing as well, because that was the other thing. in Ghost of Tsushima and like Red Dead as well, Red Dead Redemption, like you have a horse, so you don't necessarily have to run the whole time. And I know you can mount horse machines as well, but you have to find one, and like they're not always around. So like 95% of the time I've been running around, which is a bit slow every now and then. But it's really cool because like it's this like combination of obviously futuristic machinery stuff, AI, but then also like all the little towns and stuff really remind me of like ancient, almost like Croatia or like, you know, the Baltics. Like it's a really interesting style. And as soon as you like go out of those towns, you kind of like forget that you're in this futuristic world. And then you turn a corner and all of a sudden there's this big machine running at you, like fucking scares the shit out of you, you know? So yeah, it's been really good. Highly recommend. Well,
I guess related to our discussion topic, is anyone still weaving denim in that future?
I haven't spotted anyone yet, but I'll find them. Don't worry.
A massive walk-in loom.
That was actually my favorite part of Ghost of Tsushima, is when you find the dye houses.
Mm.
I was like, oh, yeah. It's so cool. I mean, I don't think there's an Indigo dye house, but nonetheless, it was such a cool little kind of location to stumble upon.
Yeah, cool. Ilya, what have you been up to?
Well, I'd like to mention that yesterday, for the first time, I visited Dawson Denim down in Brighton and Hove.
Lovely.
I had previously attempted several times and been unlucky with the shop being closed, either due to lockdown or just it not being open. So it was actually really great to see the space and see behind the shop where they've got the sewing machines set up, you know, where they're making the garments, and also to meet Kelly as well. That was really great to have a, you know, conversation about, you know, how they're doing, how they started, and all those kind of interesting things. So yeah, we were there yesterday, and yeah, all the family loved it, and we'll definitely return and be back at some point. I picked up a salt and pepper chambray shirt, which they make in collaboration with Triple Stitch, who are based in London. It's quite a nice boxy cut. I kind of sized up one because should shrink a little bit, but yeah, really like the fit. The quality of the fabric is quite nice and sturdy. I'm sure it'll wash in and be quite nice. So yeah, it was long time coming, but yeah, it's nice to finally support Dawson in some kind of way. And at some point I'm probably gonna grab some black jeans from them in their wide leg cut, because that's something I haven't had for quite some time, a black pair of jeans. The last pair I had was a Left Field NYC pair, which really, really slim on me, and yeah, I couldn't fit into them anymore, and actually sold them quite recently. So yeah, it'd be nice to own a black pair again at some point.
Do Dawson still make all of their stuff like all themselves in their studio behind the shop?
Yes. Apart from some of the shirting, which they've obviously collaborated with Triple Stitch, who were making those. I think all the rest of the stuff, like the jackets and the jeans, they're doing themselves. So I think between Kelly, Scott, I think they've got one other person who's, I think, a pattern cutter and also, sews as well. So yeah, I think between the three of them, they make the garments there at the moment.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I grew up on the South Coast, just down near Brighton, but I've never had a chance to make it across to see them guys, but
Definitely. It's a really cool space as well. The way they've laid it out, you know, they've got like a hanging motorcycle in there, which belonged to, I think, Kelly's grandfather. Yeah, it's just a really nice, nice place. It's a little bit out of the way from Brighton itself. But if you walk along the seafront, it's a really nice way to get there.
Cool.
So it is walkable.
It's walkable, yeah. I definitely recommend anyone who's kind of in the vicinity or visiting Brighton to pop in there and have a look. Because you know, there's not that many places where you can actually see, you know, garments being made in Britain in that kind of fashion.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's quite nice they're being made and then sold pretty much next door, all in the
exactly. Yeah, and you know, Kelly let me try on a pair which didn't have any hardware on yet, just so I could figure out the sizing and things like that. So you know, you have that kind of flexibility to see, you know, what an unfinished item could be like, and you know, you have that, you know, that see the process as well. And obviously, they can hem the jeans on site as well if needs be, or do any repairs. I think they offer, you know, free repairs for life as well on their garments, which is always a nice touch. And I think they were the first British brand to offer that kind of service.
Yeah, I remember about 5 years ago or so, they did a pop-up at Timothy Everest on Red Church Street. And like they were there for, I think, maybe a couple weeks or so. And they brought like a bunch of their sewing machines and stuff. I spent some time talking to them. And it's just so cool how their knowledge they were sharing and, you know, kind of advice on sewing machines to buy, like where to get them. And just really, really cool how they're trying to sort of like help other makers sort of get into the hobby or kind of know where to start and stuff. And they're very instrumental and kind of helping me decide to try some work in that space for a while.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I think there will be doing a pop-up in London at some point in the next few months as well. So it'll be another good occasion to meet up with people and to see that.
As we're talking about clothes, I'll stick to clothes. So, I'm back, by the way. So apologies for last episode. I say apologies. I was, when you guys were recording, I would have literally been sitting on a beach somewhere. So I'm not sorry at all. But I listened to the episode and Ed was an excellent stand-in anyway. So it all worked out for the best. But yeah, anyway, because of that, I've got a few things to mention because I've not been on for a while. So I think the first one is I bought some stuff from Hinoya online store. I don't know if have you guys used them before?
I've actually been to the shop in Tokyo.
Cool.
They've got several stores in Tokyo. it's like a gold mine in there. You know, the several shops they have, you know, slightly different brands and slightly different pieces there. So they're really a great place to visit. So what did you grab?
So I grabbed, what did I get? Oh, sorry. Got sort of sent stuff over from Japan. Service was really good. Everything came really quickly. Got hit with import duty as per usual, but it seems reasonably good value. So even with the import, it was still a lot cheaper than buying stuff in the UK. So I just got a few t-shirts. I got a couple of Whitesville, just plain white t-shirts.
That's what I bought from them as well.
Amazing quality, really nice. I got the wrong size, so they're too big for me. But I gave them to
exactly the same problem. The guy eyed me up and he said, "Oh, you're gonna need like you know, extra large size."
Yeah.
And because I was, you know, we were kind of in the rush, I was like, okay, I'll trust your instinct and go for it. And then, yeah, came back and it was like huge on me. So I passed it on to Seba, who's a little bit, you know, bulkier, musclier than.
I did the same. I gave them to my gave them to the brother-in-law who's slightly bigger than me, and they fit him perfectly. And I was like, you know what? It doesn't matter.
It's a nice present. What else?
Happy birthday!
Yeah. Although he's just had, him and his wife have just had a new baby, so I don't think the white t-shirts will be staying white that long, but never mind. And then I also bought a Sunsurf Hawaiian Lily Hawaiian shirt. I like Kev, I've been getting into party shirts as well, so you've got party shirt.
Join
Kev.
The party.
Yeah.
Kevin's influence is reaching all corners of the world.
Party.
I think I decided this. Because, as you guys know, I kind of have a uniform. In winter, I basically just live in jeans and plaid shirts. And I kind of decided in summer I'm going to do the same, make life easy, so I don't need to think about what I wear, but just with Hawaiian shirts. And I think that's partly because obviously this year's been a bit crappy with lockdowns and all the stuff that's been going on. I thought at least my shirts can be fun. So I bought a few Hawaiian shirts over the past year, but I think the Sunsurf ones are probably the best, really good quality. I really like the fact the prints, they have a limited color palette because they're based on like the classic prints, which would have been silkscreen printed. So rather than like the modern ones, which you've got about a million colors on, you know, it's a really simple color palette of like four or five different colors. Really well made, all the classic detailing you'd expect from a Hawaiian shirt, like horizontal buttonholes and matching the print on the front pocket. And actually with that one, I got the fit about right. So yeah, super happy with it. So I would recommend one, Sunsurf shirts, and two, using Hinoya store if you guys want to get stuff sent over from Japan.
Yeah, they stock a lot of Toyo brands.
Oh yes, yeah.
Sure do.
Yeah, that's anyone else want to go? Anyone else got any interests? Tom, how about you?
Yeah, I've not been up to much. I went to Wales a couple of weeks ago. And I was the only person climbing the tallest peak in England in jeans, which was quite fun. Luckily, it wasn't super warm that day, but I think I was probably sweating more than the average person. And I did have actually a guy pass me as I was like scrambling across a ledge, pretty much. Be like, oh, you're I think the best dressed guy on the mountain. I was like, yes. Yes, I want a wart of that.
Thanks,
please.
Mate.
I want that on a plaque on my wall. But yeah, I mean, apart from that, David, I was watching Lad Hood the other day that you recommended.
Oh, it's so funny.
Which is a hilarious program on BBC. just about a guy growing up in the north and just the ridiculous things he done as a child.
Oh my God, that show's so funny. It's like the best of In-Betweeners and like American Pie and I don't know, like more street humor. I'm not sure the right term for it, but it's like more authentic versions of those two shows.
Yeah. It's just super, super northern, and they just like go out to the forest and do weed and yeah, it's just mental. You have to watch it to kind of figure it out. But yeah, it's pretty funny. And yeah, I've been watching some other good programs. There was Vigil, which is also on BBC. About
do you get into that one?
Yeah. It takes an episode or two.
Okay.
Because at first I was just like, it's all right, but then it starts to get really good because it's kind of going, it's split between what's happening onshore, kind of in Scotland, and they're investigating from their side, and they're having to talk to MI5 and like the Royal Navy because, you know, it's a murder on a submarine that's meant to hold like, you know, world destroying nuclear weapons, and they're like, a bit strange, someone has been murdered on this submarine. And then the police officer who gets sent to the submarine and her trying to investigate it while navigating you know, kind of the hierarchy of a Royal Navy ship like that. So yeah, it's pretty nuts.
I've got a bit of a thing for Ygritte from Game of Thrones.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
I just want to see if she runs around telling people, you know nothing.
No, she's really good in it. She doesn't even have an accent, so it's a bit weird. Yeah, that's about it from me, really. And Sex Education starred on Netflix, which is amazing. We haven't watched it all yet, but it's fucking so good. There's one episode where they're like on a school trip in France.
No spoilers.
Okay.
I'm just about to start it.
Just wait for that episode. I think it's the fourth episode, and it's just, I was creased.
If you need another good show, my partner got me into Ghosts. I don't know if you've seen that. It's like basically this young married couple inherit like an old stately home in the UK. And lo and behold, it's haunted with like a British World War II general, like an old caveman, like a lady from like the witch trial. So like basically different dead ghosts throughout time. Let's say 10 or so ghosts. And the cast on it is the same cast who did that children's show Horrible Histories.
Horrible Histories, yeah, I was about to say.
Yeah, so it's all the same people. And it's basically like I'm not going to, I can't tell any more without spoiling it, but the young couple who moved there basically have to deal with all of the haunted ghosts and stuff. And it's become so popular here that they're now going to do an American version of it in like New England with like American versions of all the same characters. But the British one's awesome. I've really enjoyed it.
One thing I can recommend for you, probably David, you'd enjoy it, is watch this space. Sorry, not watch this space. Watch the sound with Mark Ronson. And that's on Apple TV. And it's a short documentary series, about, I think, 6-7 episodes. And it's him looking at different techniques in the music industry. So he goes from looking at sampling, auto-tune, synthesizers, reverb, things like that. And he talks with artists that, you know, he's collaborated with, worked with, like Paul McCartney. Who else is in there? The guy from Tame Impala. People like that. So, and I think DJ Premier's on the sampling one, and they actually make a track together. I think he finds some samples for him to, you know, to chop up and to make a beat with, and yeah, it's really interesting to see the process of that, and to go into the history of some of those techniques and equipment, like the synthesizers, for example. So I think, yeah, you'd really enjoy the deep dive into that.
Well, if anyone's got an iPhone, I downloaded the Reason app, which is free on iOS. I'm not sure if they even have it on Android, but it basically gives you like a basic drum machine, basic synth, and a couple of bits like that. I think it's called Reason Compact. So I've been like making some beats and stuff on the train. It's
oh, nice. Yeah, I used to use the computer version. Maybe back 10 years ago or something like that. It was a little bit out of my league in terms of my music knowledge, but it was fun to use.
Yeah, check out the iOS one, because it's like it's free to do some subset of the features. So
yeah, I remember you'd have to do the wiring yourself from the amplifier to the specific synthesizer or the drum machine to stack them up. That was always interesting.
Yeah, so that whole flipping around backwards thing is not part of the iOS app.
Okay, yeah.
Patching cables.
Yes.
Cool. I guess maybe I'll add one more second bit for second round before we move on. And Mr. Porter had a big sale a little while back, and I managed to get myself a Filson briefcase for going back to work. Yeah, I've had my eye on a Filson briefcase for... gosh, man, probably like 5 years or so I've wanted one. And very nice. 'Cause my Filson tote's pretty much the most useful thing I own, out of like even like more useful than shoes, more useful than belts. I mean, that tote bag is like the greatest thing of all time. I've always wanted a briefcase, and Mr. Porter, I guess, at the end of each season starts knocking stuff off, like 50% off, 60% off, 70% off, until it's all gone. So I got the bag, I think, 60% off, which ironically is not too dissimilar from like what it would cost in the States. So I was like, well, at least I'm paying American prices, I guess. But yeah, it's pretty rad. Like the construction's amazing. You know, it's got the handles, so you can carry it kind of briefcase style. It's got the shoulder strap. You know, it's got the kind of four outside pockets that every Filson bag has. And then the inside, there's two kind of like sleeve pockets. So, you can fit like a 15-inch laptop in it, a little snugly, and the zippers are kind of like scraping on the laptop as it goes into it, but it still does fit. And then it's got some kind of like, you know, pen pockets and whatever else pockets. So once I'm going back to work and going into the office a bit, it should prove quite useful. And I wanted an all black one, but they actually don't make the black ones anymore.
And no neon versions.
No, but I got my next favorite thing after, like, you know, indigo and black and neon green is kind of like bright blue. And it's like the color blue off the American flag. They call it flag blue. So it's kind of actually nice. It looks navy here.
I've seen the Instagram post that you put up. Yeah, it's nice. Nice.
Yeah,
color.
Yeah. But it's really cool. It's already kind of breaking in a little bit of marks here and there, some patina. Really cool. The only thing I'm a bit unsure about is, I know with Filson bags, they're quote unquote rugged twill is a 20 ounce cotton twill. So it's not synthetic. It's like 100% cotton. And they, in the manufacturing process, Millerain does like a little bit of waxing of it. I think it's Millerain canvas. I know it's British canvas, but I forgot if it's Millerain. But over time, that obviously kind of wears off and it kind of helps with the patina and the breaking in of the bag. But I haven't really found any good resources yet to see like if you can re-wax the canvas. I mean, presumably you could do, but like...
Yeah, of course you can. Of course you can.
Because it's not like a paraffin wax that you can like see it on the bag. It's like maybe like a spray wax or something.
It could be already kind of in, you know, in the fabric. It's probably been heated up and processed where you,
exactly,
you know, you're not seeing it. But yeah, of course, if it's canvas, it's cotton, there's no reason why you won't be able to re-wax it, you know, in the future.
One thing I did run across was when I bought those Vibergs on eBay a couple months back, they're like a suede. And so I was looking for like suede protectors that aren't like mega chemical, that are more kind of natural. And I found the French company Saphir makes one called Super Invulner, I guess like invulnerability, like Super Invulner. And it's like a spray wax finish that you don't see it. It's mega waterproof and it apparently kind of like flakes off over time as opposed to like being permanently stuck in the suede. And you can use it for a bunch of different stuff. Like it's not just for suede, like anything that you want to, you know, stain protect, you can use it. So I'm wondering if maybe that kind of product might be more appropriate as like a Filson bag breaks in to kind of keep it, water resistant.
I'm sure that will work very well as well.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens. It'll be interesting to see how this breaks in. But my old tote, I mean, it's gone through everything and it still looks awesome. So still a big Filson fan. Ilya, anything from you?
Yeah, I'd like to add that I've joined Black Horse Lane Ateliers on a 1 day a week gig, and I'm helping them with their photography and social media. Thank you.
Nice.
So that's really exciting. I'm really, you know, I'm on my second week in. So you can, you know, check the posts out, which I'm putting onto their feed at Black Horse Lane. And yeah, it's really nice to be involved with them because, you know, knowing the brand for the last 5-6 years, you know, with David introducing me to them and seeing the factory all those years ago, you know, and doing a little bit of modeling again because of David's recruitment. It's been really nice. And, you know, I've always kept touch with them and visited them. And so it just makes sense because I think we kind of know each other, how we, you know, what we stand for and, you know, what we believe in and things like that. So, yeah, it's been really nice to work from the inside, I guess. Yeah, I can see David's handiwork everywhere. which is still, you know, instrumental and fundamental in how a lot of things were set up there, which is nice. But yeah, I'm really excited at the chance and opportunity to, you know, explore and pursue my passions and hobbies and turn it into something a little bit more. So yeah, that's been quite a nice thing starting in September for me.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Like I remember when Kevin and I first went to their launch party, I think, I forgot, maybe Kevin, you had discovered it somehow. Like you'd heard a rumor of a jeans company opening up in London. And we kind of like RSVP'd for the launch party and come to find out it was in my neighborhood at the time. And then, we went, met Han and met his co-founder Toby and sort of kind of a whole bunch of other cool people were there, like Katie and Bobbin from Story MFG and other folks like Rudy from Son of a Stag. So really cool kind of like coming together. And Mosin was there from Indrime. So many cool people there from the industry. And Yeah, then ended up, you know, kind of working there for a couple of years with Han.
Was that the launch party where there was nothing in there at all? And it's just an empty shell?
No, they had the cutting table.
Okay.
And they had, I think they had some of the sewing machines, but like maybe all pushed to the side.
Yeah. No, so I was about to say, I went to, I think, one of their other parties before that. So I was like, oh shit, we didn't run into each other, did we?
I mean, it could have been the same one.
Maybe we did,
Yeah, I've got some photos somewhere. I can go back and look at my old photos, and maybe it is the same. They had like blue kind of banners hanging everywhere, like kind of like party bunting or whatever the word is for it, but like blue.
Yeah, I can't remember.
I can't remember much of it either. I think the only thing I remember is Han's jacket. Did he have the jacket already at that point? Pretty sure he
did. Yeah, like brand new. It was like a brand new production sample at that point.
And then, like, the next time I saw him, it was all worn in. Now, that jacket is probably one of the most beautiful jackets I've ever seen. It's so good.
Kevin, have you seen Ken's jacket, which is in the store now? It was recently
it's lit.
Recently posted on there. It's framed now. That is incredible.
Framed,
apparently.
Yeah, I've got it up now. Yeah, that's
apparently he didn't want to give that jacket up because, you know, he'd been wearing that for a long time and taking that off his
back. I wouldn't want to.
No.
<It's> beautiful.
they gave him a new one, obviously, and he wasn't too pleased.
So I guess carrying on the theme of making jeans, I know Tom mentioned it in the last episode. I do listen when I wasn't in it. I've been working with Tom over the last few months in helping him develop a new cut jeans for United Overalls. So we are pretty much finished now. The cut is ready, and I think, Tom, you're pretty much happy with it. There's no more changes.
Yeah. I mean, I went up a mountain in them, so I think, you know, they're pretty good enough.
Cool.
Mountain tested.
Yeah, although, to be honest, Lex, you did sew in the back buckle the wrong way around, so I did have to take that out.
I've never done one before, so I wasn't 100% sure, so I just guessed it, and I was
buckle doesn't quite do up right.
That's all right, that's a pretty easy thing to do. It's I think quite a straightforward process, really. I mean, basically, Tom had a good idea of what he wanted to do. He wanted to kind of create a wider, more traditional cut. So the starting point from what we did was to use one of his old patterns, so from his ED1 jeans. And basically, we added, was it about an inch or so in the rise? I can't remember now.
Yeah, something like inch and a half and then an inch width on everything. Got to make everything wider.
And then made the opening super wide as well. Obviously, we twirled them up, started by kind of creating a really basic twirl in, I think, some horrible cheap denim. Didn't even do pockets or any details like that to get a really basic idea of the fit, which actually we managed to get right pretty much first time with a few minor tweaks. Then I did a sample in Final Fabric using 99% kind of finalized construction methods of how it would be done at Black Horse Lane, other than apparently sewing the back buckle in the wrong way around, but it's part of the process. And then that seemed to go quite well. Again, as Tom said, he's made it up a mountain in them, which I think is a pretty good sign for a pair of jeans. So next, I have finalized the patterns, got them all production ready. So now it's just a question of Tom and Black Horse Lane working together to kind of do their pre-production sample and then production. I finished that, I think, a couple of weeks ago now. So that's another thing we've been up to.
When are you looking to launch, Tom?
Well, Black Horse Lane are busy for a fair few months after Christmas. So, it'll take a little while. Don't hold your breath. Hopefully, kind of spring next year, we'll be able to like close out. So I just need to have a meet with them, make sure they can do it all. Go on, Lex.
will they be able to do your sampling before then, or is it just like nothing at all until next year?
I imagine they'll be able to do at least kind of maybe the sampling if they can fit it in, and at least kind of get the pattern grading and everything done. So then we'll just wait for the kind of factory space to become available, which it's great to hear that they're super super busy, either with projects from third parties or their own stuff. It's good news. I'm in no rush. It would have been nice to have got them out before Christmas, but it's one of those things.
Wonder if you could do like a pre-order, so like folks could get their pre-order in with you before Christmas as like a gift for someone, and then they get fulfilled once the manufacturing is done.
Yeah, we were kind of, so me and the other guys that I kind of run the business with, as in my dad and my mate, they're not some mysterious multimillionaire benefactors. We could always kind of do it as pre-orders, get the people kind of booking in their sizes, and then kind of just roll from there. I think Lex, you're also going to make me some very nice aprons as well, hopefully.
Oh, yeah.
If you get any free time in between university.
Again, I will be making aprons as well. But again, that might have to wait a little bit, because I think, as I mentioned before, my girlfriend and I are buying a house, and we move into a new house we get the keys on Wednesday, so in about 3 days' time. So my kind of life is going to be pretty hectic for a couple of months, but I should be able to get some done before Christmas if that's when you want them for. Maybe aim to do it November-ish, something like that. Hopefully things will be.
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds good.
We can discuss close to the time.
Look at this. Business deals being done on the podcast.
Business adjourned.
and that was the news section.
Yeah.
I feel like we do need a news jingle.
if you want to write one, we can totally integrate it.
Cool. I'll get on it.
Cool. Let's jump into the news. Looking at the board here, some of the stuff's a bit on the older side. Some of it's newer. I think the one thing that's worth speaking about, that's probably the biggest standout, is the Ironheart and Saunders Supplies. So Saunders Supplies is Ironheart's kind of side business, Ironheart UK, where they basically do like a retail, online retail presence for some of the brands they really love. Oftentimes they're collaborators and stuff, but both companies are teaming up from the 2nd to the 7th of November for a pop-up shop in Shoreditch in London. They've also, I believe, got a launch event on one particular night. I'm pulling up their Instagram, that you can sign up to attend.
I have signed up.
Where is it?
It's the 6th of November.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm struggling to find it. So they'll have this shop, 6-day pop-up shop. Can see Ironheart's core items, everything that came out in Fall Winter 21 collection, sneak peek of some of the stuff in Spring Summer 22 collection, and some of the Saunders Supplies brands they like to carry as well. And then pop-up party Saturday 6th of November that you can RSVP for online. To me, this is quite an interesting one, because I know pre-pandemic they were actually looking at setting up a permanent shop in around Old Street and Shoreditch. So this to me seems like maybe due to the pandemic they're not going for like a permanent spot, but maybe doing like a pop-up spot to kind of see how it works. I think that's pretty cool. I know at Black Horse we did kind of the same thing, where we did like a pop-up shop for a while before Han launched the permanent shop at King's Cross. I think we're probably all hoping to attend this launch event. Is that right? Everyone's going to try and make it out,
including Kevin.
I was going to say I probably won't make it, but
true. I think Kevin, we still feel like you're conceptually with us here in the UK, even though you're in Oz.
Yeah, it's funny though. Like, they're talking about opening up borders again now, but the funny thing is that they're talking about opening up international borders whilst state borders, domestic state borders, are still closed. So there's a big chance that from Sydney, at least, we can fly to London before we can fly to Melbourne or Perth. So, yeah, I might actually join. Who knows?
We can always jump on one of those American submarines and just go visit the States instead. Yeah.
Exactly.
But yeah, it's cool. I think it's quite nice to see Ironheart sort of branch out. Mm. I think on their Ironcast podcast, where they did like a whole episode with Giles's son, who kind of runs all their e-commerce and retail and all that stuff. I think this is kind of his strategy. So it's interesting to see what direction he takes the brand in from a retail standpoint, brick and mortar standpoint. Yeah, it'll be cool. I always struggle with Ironheart because their pricing's a bit steep, or such that I usually don't want to buy their stuff. But at the same time, I wanted a pair of their 666 jeans in the black over dye for so long, and that's like the week before my 40th birthday. So could be dangerous.
Dangerous. Yeah.
Leave the wallet at home.
Yeah, definitely.
If you don't want to buy.
Yeah, the pop-up's about 100 meters from my work, so it might be quite an expensive week for me.
Oh, no.
Nice.
Cool. I guess maybe one other bit of interesting news, and maybe Ilya, you can tell us a bit more about it, is that I saw that Black Horse Lanes launched military-inspired sandals and then also has some sneakers coming up with denim offcuts, it looks like, used for the sneakers.
Yeah, so the sneakers, I think they're in the final sampling stages. I saw those in the factory. I think they're just waiting for the final batch to be delivered to them before they can properly launch it. But yeah, it's the denim is Candiani, which they're using, which they were using for their jeans. And Black Horse Lane are always looking at ways of, you know, reusing their offcuts, whether they're donating them or, you know, giving them to either students or local companies who have their own projects. This time around they decided, well, why can't we make a sneaker with this, you know, with these offcuts? So I believe they found a factory in Italy who were able to do this for them. I think they looked around England and somewhere close by, but no one was willing to do it. But this Italian factory were. So yeah, they're going to be coming in two colors, indigo and ecru. They have some nice leather finishing on the uppers as well. It's looking like a really nice, clean, kind of minimalistic tennis shoe kind of sneaker, so that's quite exciting when that launches. And in terms of the sandals, that those already have launched and are in store, as far as I'm aware. I think it's kind of happened before I was there. I think it's been something in the works for a couple of, maybe a year and a half, I think Khan was telling me. And it's based on a Italian military sandal. And again, they sought production in the UK, but no one was able to do it. And they managed to find a little family-run workshop in Turkey who were able to achieve what Han was after. And so they come in, I think, four or five colors, including like a natural veg tan leather, which is my favorite one because I think it'll, you know, perfect for sunning out when you're on holidays, or, you know, just out and about. That's going to develop really nicely, and it's going to be, I assume it looks like it's going to be a nice kind of brown, maybe a cognac color eventually. So that looks really good. I think they also come in red, navy. I think I'm missing a color.
Yeah, it's like black, navy, red, natural, and maybe white, or just natural.
No, natural. I don't think there's a white version.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember back when I worked there, he actually had acquired the old military issue, like originals. So it's quite cool to see, you know, him kind of get the originals from like a surplus store. And then, you know, years later, you've got the actual kind of new product based upon those. So it's cool to see those kind of come to market. So in terms of other news, nothing too interesting. One little thing I saw was, I know recently Robin Denham launched a collaboration gene with Denimio and Momotaro. Yeah. Interesting. Like, I was really kind of juiced up on a gene with a cobalt weft. Like, blue weft genes are always kind of one of my favorite things. But I personally was a bit turned off by some of the details, feeling like it was a bit gaudy looking. But I saw Denimio posted yesterday that it's their fastest selling collaboration of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite interesting to see if we see more Denim in the direction of, like, kind of not ostentatious, but, you know, kind of more flash details as opposed to kind of, you know, APC and the kind of like super minimalist style way of doing jeans. I wonder if this is an indication of direction that, you know, more kind of flourishes and details as opposed to less.
Back to the Evisus from the 90s.
Yeah, I remember they've got the one pair where it's like the arcuates are painted like all the way up the leg.
Yeah,
across
exactly.
The back and like all the way down.
35 seagulls on the denim everywhere.
Please no.
I think you could be right, David. I think we will be seeing some more of those kind of things. Hopefully not too many, but I think you could be right.
Yeah, it's interesting because I like the kind of like streetwear and urban styles to a degree, like that kind of inspiration. But yeah, it feels to me like it only works if it's like really minimal and like really pared down. And so, yeah, I personally hope that the style doesn't go in the direction of like flourishes and details, but it definitely seems like it might do.
I think like Momotaro with the stripes, it just allows for a bit of craziness in there. I don't think a lot of other brands have a detail on their jeans that would allow them, apart from a leather patch or a funky patch or anything. Like, I can't see TCB or Warehouse or whoever all of a sudden slapping something on a back pocket, you know, just to go with that trend. But I did see Robin Denham post on Instagram that because it was the fastest selling collab they've ever done, he asked his followers if they wanted a jacket in the same fabric. So
that means a jacket is coming.
That probably means a jacket is coming. Yeah. Yeah.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's hope it's not a type 2 with the handle warmers pockets.
With big old stripes.
Love a good hand warmer pockets, mate. Come on.
Yeah. On the type 3. That's fine.
Yeah, we'll see. It's funny, like with the Momotaro jackets, because of the stripes are so like visible on the jacket. Like, I saw a guy the other day walk past in a denim jacket with the two stripes. I'm like, bloody hell, must be Momotaro, can't be anyone else. So staring at him, he's like,
well, the battle stripes are definitely quite distinguishable, aren't they?
Yeah. Someone at my work, I like looked his ass going past, like, is that Momotaro?
And people, well, yeah, did you paint two stripes on the?
I have to say, I love when people do those kinds of details, but that only reveal with wear. So, like, I know, you know, when Rivet and Hyde did their collaborations with Ironheart, they, instead of having like copper arcuates that you see from day one, it's like they would have navy stitching arcuates. So like as the jeans fade, the arcuates reveal themselves, or like some of my old Imperial jeans are like that. And it feels like either having like, you know, battle stripes that maybe look indigo or look navy and only reveal like when you fade the denim, like that kind of stuff's interesting. So it's like the detail, but it's subtle.
So as a concept, David, would you buy a pair of black denim with neon battle stripes?
No, too gaudy.
Really?
No. I mean, I like neon, but it has to be like homogeneous. So for example, like that Levi's trucker I have, it's all one color. So it's like, it's almost like,
let me get this straight. So black and neon will be too goldy, but just the jacket by itself being all neon is not.
I guess to say it more specifically, I like bold colors and I like bright, but I don't like detail so much. It's like, I don't like patterns so much. I don't like kind of like embellishments and flourishes. So like, you know, right. if it's all uniform and like all one color, like to me, that's more pared down than like, I don't know, putting a pattern that stands out. So it's like,
I get you. You just want a little bit more minimalism.
Like to me, like color, you can have a very bright color and it still be minimal if the details are as such. But like, yeah, like I wouldn't want. Well, actually, I stand corrected. There was a raffle at some point for a pair of Momotaro sample jeans that had like pretty much like a neon lime style battle stripe and neon lime weft, and the rest of the garment was, I think, indigo or black. And I bid on them, you know, like they had like an auction for charity. I'd probably wear them, but yeah, there's a point where like it becomes too flash. And it's a bit subjective, I guess, in terms of what's too flash or not.
Fair enough. You've got your own criteria.
Yeah, there you go. All right. So for today's discussion topic, we're going to talk about our scene or our hobby in the future.
Future.
So the idea is, you know, kind of look at what the hobby is going to be 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 50 years from now. It doesn't matter. So kind of put together some questions for the team to think about. And so, yeah, I guess, does anyone want to kind of jump into one of these?
What will happen with raw denim? So if we're looking at trends and what's happening, I think we're probably moving away from cotton and going towards things like tencel, which at some point I think will probably, you know, brands will start adopting more and more. I think you're already seeing it with the pioneers like Mosin, you know, releasing stuff. So I think it's not going to be too long until other brands start to do the same.
And for those that don't know what tencel is, it's basically a fabric that feels a lot like 100% cotton, but it's a mixture of new or recycled cotton and wood pulp from trees. So basically you can take like, you know, essentially like tree branches, grind them up, and essentially kind of weave the tree fibers into something very similar to cotton.
Yeah. So alongside tencel, we're probably going to see more hemp. I would imagine, and maybe other. I'm sure there'll be other breaking
linen as well.
Linen, yeah, and things like that. You'll probably see more of those fabrics being used. Now, I don't think, you know, cotton's going to be completely gone and not going to be used, but I think that's one of the things that you will see probably more of in this world.
So one thing I've also seen is in the kind of like sportswear industry, they're getting into these like eco dyes for like, you know, like running shoes or whatever that use less chemicals and lower quantities and just kind of like more clever ways to dye synthetics. I wonder if we're going to see any changes with how indigo dyeing happens.
I think there will always kind of be a divide between kind of more mainstream, kind of high streety, very big production brands and kind of, you know, our scene type brands that, you know, will probably stick to the more traditional 100% cotton. You know, I can see, you know, like H&M doing a tencel, you know, range of denim and stuff like that. I don't really see brands like, you know, TCB wouldn't pick it up because they'll be like, well,
not straight away, but look, I wouldn't have thought that 316 would be doing stonewashed denim, you know, 5 years ago, and here we are. So yep. why not, why will they not go and use things like Tensil in another 5 years. Maybe the traditional repro brands, I agree, might not want to go in there because, you know, all, what they're about is trying to make, you know, Levi's from the 50s, 40s, and you know, and so on. But I think people who don't have those limitations in what their brands are about will, I think, will start looking towards, you know, new technologies. They don't have to be bound up in these old, you know, and ways just to of keep, making it.
And just to keep it interesting, let's keep the discussion focused on like brands within our sphere. So like, let's not worry about high street and stuff just because it's obvious what they're going to do. But like, let's try and.
Can I also, does anyone actually own any jeans that are a Tencel blend, you guys?
Not currently.
No, but I've felt the fabric and it's not quite cotton. It's very close, but I think it works well for like washed out and bleached style.
Is it similar? Is it like eating a vegan burger?
Yeah, like it ain't meat. it feels odd. It feels very smooth, and I think if you're probably a brand that is used to making denim in raw and quite heavy, it probably isn't.
But surely that's based on the weave that those particular denim that you touched. I'm guessing they could manufacture and could try and replicate a more slubby feel or, you know, a more...
Possibly, yeah. I mean, probably what I felt like the samples that I touched was, you know, not designed to be that kind of raw denim feel, it still didn't quite feel like cotton. Like, it didn't quite feel like 100% cotton jean, you know, even in a kind of wash state. So it would be interesting to see what it's like woven up as a traditional fabric, and if that, you know, still translates across quite well, because I love fabrics that are cotton linen. So I think Hewitt Heritage, is it cotton linen? Yeah.
They do both.
Yeah. And that fabric's really, really nice. And the cotton wool one was really good. So wool's another good.
What do you think about it, Lex? Have you felt the Tencel fabric?
No, I've not. Okay. I mean, I think broadening the fabric range is obviously, from a sustainability point of view, a really good thing. But I kind of agree with Tom. I don't think it will take off that much within our sphere. I think you might get brands doing a line of kind of Tencel mix, but I think most brands will stick to the main offering will still kind of just be pure cotton.
I feel like the Japanese will be the last to adopt it, like the Japanese brands who are, you know, especially the repro brands will be the last ones to adopt it. I feel like the European and maybe the American ones will be quicker to jump on to it. I think European will be even quicker than the American ones. I think it will be Europe, America, and then Japan in that kind of order that will adopt these kind of things.
I could see like brands like maybe someone like Tellison kind of doing, you know, a line or something quite classic, but using these modern fabrics perhaps. But I don't know. I think the uptake will be quite slow, but you never know. As we look long term, we're talking about looking into the future. You know, if we're going 30, 40, 50 years, when maybe making cotton will become, there won't be enough water and it will become too expensive, then maybe the industry will be forced to find alternatives.
Exactly. And then how many of the brands who are around today are still going to be around in, you know, 20 years time? If these brands are owned by, you know, a one man, like let's take Rogue Territory, for example, you know, it's owned by Carl and Leslie. 30 years down the line, will that brand still be there? Will they still be running it? Will they be doing something else perhaps? And so other companies are going to, you know, come in, and younger, you know, generations are going to come in, and will they still be that married to cotton, or whether, you know, they'll be a lot more open to using, you know, new fabrics?
Two interesting questions just kind of popped up from what y'all were mentioning. I think one, Lex, you kind of mentioned about, you know, will we be growing cotton? I think there's an interesting discussion point there around like cotton being grown like in sort of like vertical farming, indoor factories, that kind of thing to explore. And then to Ilya, to your point, I think there's an interesting question to talk about in terms of like, will future generations even care about, you know, workwear and heritage, right? Like we've got, let's say, grandparents who maybe wore this stuff when they were growing up, and so it's relevant to us. But like, will kids who are just now being born even care about these kinds of this kind of scene when they're grown up? So maybe two interesting discussion points there. Any thoughts on either of those?
So on that second point, I guess like, yeah, in like 25, 50 years, there might not even be a scene anymore, right? That's what you're hinting at, because, you know, maybe the kids don't care about heritage fabrics or whatever. Yeah, that's an interesting one.
I think it could still come, you know, I think it will kind of come in and out of maybe popularity, you know, especially, you know, compare about 10 years ago when everyone was starting a raw denim brand. But I feel like denim is quite heavily linked to counterculture and not conforming to ideals. So it may kind of drift out, but then there will probably be like another group that then picks it up, you know, maybe pick it up in a different way or interpret it in a slightly different way than, you know, maybe we have or the Japanese do or the Americans do. Because even if you look at the scenes now, you know, the European market's very different to America and Japan. You know, they absolutely all kind of link in similar themes, and you know, there's different things that they pick up along the way. So I imagine it will evolve. And you know, it might fade a little bit. You might see, you know, brands start to shut down, or you know, just the smaller ones who manage to survive because, you know, they're working on just, you know, very, very small runs. But you know, I imagine it'll come back. Especially kind of when I joined, a lot of it was, you know, people who were into, you know, hardcore punk and stuff like that. You know, there will always be kind of that new version for the next generation.
And I think people and the younger generation will always kind of look backwards to things, you know, when, you know, you still have people who are in, you know, into Led Zeppelin, Beatles in terms of, you know, music scene. They're going to look back. Same with films, same with other, you know, cultures. So I don't necessarily think people are going to completely discount everything that's happened from, you know, the last 100 years. And I think they'll still take influence from these spheres.
Yeah. It'll take it a little bit longer for it to completely disappear, I guess. And like fashion in general is quite a circular thing, right? Like there's always things from the past that come back. I don't know, like flared jeans. I see people on Instagram with flared jeans again. I'm like, okay, that's back.
No, you know? Me. All that.
But yeah.
Sorry, Kevin, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, see, I watched The Matrix last weekend just because trying to catch up before the new one. And two insights from that is like, number one, in the real world, everyone's just going to basically be wearing like linen sacks. And that's going to be everyone's wardrobe. And then the other thing is when you're in like a virtual space, which maybe we'll be spending all of our time in 30, 50 years, those kind of styles from the past were still relevant. So maybe like our virtual identities will be decked out in the best, you know, heritage and workwear, even if we're sitting like in a pod in a paper in a like a potato bag or something.
Well, things like augmented reality and those kind of things, will you be buying, you know, digital versions of the clothing that you're into? Is that what the future is?
Sick fades file 2.0.
Illegal downloads.
Well, if we're like projecting our styles as we walk around in the real world, like kind of virtual, like AR outfits, like how much wear do you want to have on your garments in your virtual outfit, right?
depends where you're going. In the office, you want like a fresh, crispy pair. If you're meeting your denim buddies, you want to have like sick fades.
You want them to fade straight when you walk out of the office, you know, exactly. Or the other way around as well. If you walk in, crisp.
Yeah, I guess to that end, like, what kind of styles do you think we'll be wearing 50 years from now? Let's assume that aging's been solved and like we're not all dead by that point, but we're
straight,
actually like
straight 501 pair with a white t-shirt.
So what you're wearing now?
Yeah, basically.
I will not change.
But I don't think that's ever going to go out of style.
Will we still be wearing like rugged wear boots 50 years from now?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I mean, I can see kind of the big boot makers, you know, celebrating their 300th anniversary or whatever. You know, it's they've lasted 200 years. Yeah, you can't really beat, you know, well-made boots that, you know, conform to your shape and leather.
We'll be wearing vat-grown leather.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, will we still be able to use leather, which in the
mushroom
same
leather?
Yeah,
mushroom leather.
Yeah, mushroom. Yeah, it's kind of one of the new spoken about kind of things is that, oh yeah, mushroom grown leather, and where the little tendrils kind of grow out and mat together in weird shapes, it forms quite a leather like material, which is quite weird.
The other one's pineapple,
wearing it.
Pineapple leather.
Oh yeah, pineapple.
Pineapple.
I don't like pineapple on my pizza, and I'm not having it on my feet.
No.
I prefer it in my cocktails, let's be honest.
Oh, man, pineapple on pizza is sacrilege.
I am going to put it out there and actually say I don't mind pineapple on pizza.
Boo, like, get off. Bring it back.
I'd never go to a proper pizzeria, but when you're in a kind of like a, you know, dirty pizzeria, you know, not proper Italian style, and I got ham and pineapple, sometimes I'll go for it, but I don't.
Is this like one of those like it's a kebab shop, but they also do pizzas kind of thing?
Authentic. I would never go to a proper kind of Italian place to be like, oi, mate, can you put some pineapple on this, please?
And some ham.
I think so. What Lex is trying to...
Sorry. I was going to say, who would be up for wearing non-leather boots?
If they patina, boots. I would do.
It depends how close to leather it is. So I've heard a lot of people who'd have like the Doc Martens vegan ones. They are stiff as anything. So you know, if they worked on it and it did feel, you know, leather and softens up, then yeah, go for it.
Currently,
as long as it's comfortable, right, and looks great, then I don't really, I don't really care what it's made of.
But currently, most of the kind of the vegan ones aren't from pineapple or mushroom or anything like that. It's essentially just plastic, aren't they? Like pleather.
Yeah.
So from a sustainability point of view, actually, real leather is probably slightly better for the environment because it's a byproduct of food. So, so I probably right now I wouldn't buy a vegan pair of shoes. I see no point.
Yeah, and the leather is, you know, biodegradable, so it will eventually. Yeah.
And it will last longer. Like good leather lasts, you know, for years, whereas I'm pretty sure the pleather ones will just start falling to bits and go to landfill, and then they'll exist on this planet basically forever as a pair of shit shoes somewhere in a landfill site.
One question on that. I've heard a few times people mention that like Goodyear welting can only be redone a certain number of times, like you can only like re-welt a shoe 3 times or something like that, versus like the notion of being able to re-welt them to infinity. Does anyone know if like that's actually legit or not?
Well, I can imagine
it's resoling onto the welt that it's got 3 times. Eventually that welt is going to wear out, and you know, they're probably going to miss a couple of holes and stitching and fall apart. You can then take that welt off, put a new welt on, and then you've got another 3 times on that, and you can keep doing that.
It'll still be
rebuildable in the future, as long as it hasn't been like totally screwed up by the previous rebuild.
Though not entirely relevant, I saw there's a running shoe company that's come out with like rebuildable running shoes, so you can like take off the sole, take off the you know, the eyelets and different stuff like that. So it's almost kind of like being inspired by like craft products, but for like a super super high tech running shoe. So that's kind of cool to see this notion of craftability kind of get into other spaces. Speaking of lasting, do we think that our vintage sewing machines, like our selvage looms or our old union specials, all that kind of stuff, are going to be still working okay in 50 years?
Well, they've already lasted for 50 plus years, so I don't see why they wouldn't keep going.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say eventually they may break, but as long as they're taken care of, like the old machines are designed pretty much to last forever. So although I guess eventually they'll kind of give up, but if they're taken care of, I see no reason why
not. As long as they're being used and maintained and people still want to use them, they will always find a way to repair them. You know, people even now find ways to repair them by, you know, making new metal parts or things like that. So
as long as
there's a need, I think they'll be around. And I think there's enough of them around as well.
Stuff like back then was engineered to just go on and on, because the idea was like, I don't want to, as a factory owner, keep paying to replace parts and, you know, having to fix it every hour. I want that to run 24/7, you know, keep making as many products as possible. So yeah, as long as kind of these factories and manufacturers are keeping them in good nick and not just chucking them outside when they're done with them, then yeah, they should last.
I guess one more question is, what might it be like to be a maker in 50 years? So when I lived in France, the French government had subsidies for creatives. So like if you were an artist or if you were a craftsperson, you could basically get like a government provided house or apartment that like helped you basically be able to afford to do your craft. Because I know like in places like the States, being a maker can be really, really hard just to even pay your bills and you get your healthcare and stuff. So like, do you think we'll see, you know, will it still be commonplace to be a craftsperson, a maker? Would it be easier to be one, harder?
I think it will always exist, especially as we're kind of moving into a more digital realm. People will want, I don't know, a handmade experience. So I don't think it will die out. I think there will always be that. And people always be willing to pay for it. And as like, you know, robots take over more and more jobs, you never know, one day they might get to the point where, you know, you can get machines to fully make, you know, a pair of jeans, but you'll still have that hands-on. I don't think they'll be able to, you know, develop machines that can do everything, because some of these craft skills that we appreciate are so fiddly, they'll always need to be made by hand.
Yeah, because like obviously the whole world is moving more and more towards machinery and automation. But because that is happening, I think there will always be that stream on the other end of the spectrum as well. Like there will always be that, I don't know, like desire to make things by hand. And because I don't know, like I watch quite a bit of YouTube, and obviously like these people who put these videos on are digital nomads. Their whole life is online. But a lot of them now during lockdown have done projects where they had to do things with their hands, and every single one of them loved it, because they never really done anything like that. And I'm very similar. Like I've got an office job, so I don't really do much with my hands apart from typing emails. So I can imagine that will stay around. The more and more things get automated, the more and more we might see like handcrafted stuff, I think.
What kind of clothes will the robots design for us?
There'll definitely be some neon in it.
I can't help but think of what's her face, the main character from Fifth Element. That was got to be wearing those like neon orange suspenders and shit, looking like a rat.
Keep your dreams to yourself, mate.
Oh man, was it Mila Jovovich?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Kevin. You know, I think as one half of the world gets more automated, and I suppose it's a trend you're already seeing now, you know, people are bored with going to the office and want to do something a little bit more fulfilling. And I guess that's kind of why I started designing denim. It's just, you know, a nice side project. I think politically, David was kind of touching on that a little bit with kind of the support for brands. I think it'll be harder in first world countries like, you know, the UK and America for, you know, governments to continue supporting, and you know, stuff like, you know, housing and office space is going to get more and more expensive. So it'll be interesting how that side of it affects it. You know, will it become, you know, more not first world countries exploring that as they get more internet?
The government, yes, I guess it depends a little bit on. Yeah. I guess it depends a little bit on what the political spectrum will move towards, right? We don't necessarily need to move towards the more like right, you know, where it's all like markets and, you know, like freedom and that kind of stuff. Like if we do eventually, obviously it's happening still, obviously. I don't know, people might get sick of that at some point and move towards the more socialist left side where, as David said, things get, you know, people get helped by the government for certain things. I guess like also with more and more things getting automated, maybe there will be a point where we don't have to work 5 days a week, you know, or work at all. So that obviously opens up free time for people to do more things with their hands or whatever their hobbies may be.
Yeah, it's a great
if you're not working, if you're not working, do you need clothes?
So we're all going to be naked in the future. Well, what
yeah.
The point of this podcast? God.
Yeah, there's a great piece written in 2000 by Bill Joy. He was the founder of Sun Microsystems called Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. So if you Google like Why the Future Doesn't Need Us Wired, you can still read the article on their website. But he basically kind of like forecasted this sort of scenario where like everything that just kind of needs to get done is automated by machines. And we're able to spend all of our time pursuing either being on general income and doing nothing or like pursuing creative pursuits, and that like the musicians and the artists and the makers are kind of like what are most celebrated in society because there's nothing else to do otherwise. And so it's like if you're creative, you're special. So I think that's quite interesting. But one thing that comes to mind a bit is whether let's say we don't ruin the planet in 50 years and we're not all dead and it's not like Mad Max scenario yet. But, you know, if we don't fix the planet, in theory, it's going to keep getting hotter and colder in different climates. And I'm wondering, is there such a scenario where like it just becomes too hot to wear denim and boots and all that kind of stuff? And like we just can't manage it anymore.
In 10 years, we'll be like, oh, yeah, I've got that thick 10-ounce denim.
Well, I think our, you know, Malaysian friends can attest to wearing denim in the heat. So there's no reason why that still can't happen.
33-ounce, 100% humidity.
Well, if I understand correctly, that whole scene is primarily about wearing denim indoors, like in shopping centers, malls, that kind of stuff, rather than outside.
I would say the fades prove otherwise.
Yeah, they still have to get there as well. So
you don't get those kind of fades in malls and in shopping centers.
I mean, well, you could though if you
wore
their
Instagram pictures are outside at least.
But I mean, if you wore that same exact garment every single day and you were indoors, you still could get good fades just based on like duration of wear.
Yeah, but not the way they get fades. I mean, if you look at the way, you know, it's a different type of fade. It's definitely, you can see the difference between, you know, something like we would get versus what they would get in a humid country.
You spot it straight away.
Yeah, it's very, very different. And I don't think anyone here in the UK would be able to replicate that. I don't know, in Australia, I have maybe... is a little bit more dry heat in Australia.
It is.
So you probably wouldn't get the same. Yeah.
Nah, nowhere near. It gets humid a little bit in summer, but it's nowhere near the humidity levels of Southeast Asia. And they have it all year round as well, right? So yeah.
It does pose a good question. Will people still wear the same type of, you know, clothing if it gets really hot? They go for more, you know, linen-based materials or, you know.
I mean, I definitely see that over here. Like, linen is the probably most worn fabric in summer, like 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Go ahead. Sorry, Kevin.
Because like those guys in Southeast Asia, like it's a very small community, right? So it's not like there's thousands of people walking around in 33-ounce denim over there. So it's probably very similar over there. Like people will wear stuff that's a bit more breathable. Yeah. Sure.
I mean, growing up in Texas, like in the summer, it can get up to like 37 to 40 C, like 100 degrees plus Fahrenheit. And, you know, if you had an office job, you would need to wear, you know, at least like pants and a nice shirt. sorry, trousers for the British folk. I remember when I'd wear like a pair of jeans, nothing heavy, like 10 ounce, 12 ounce, whatever was popular at that time. And like either like a polo shirt or like a button down shirt. And, you know, I mean, just like walking out of your house, getting into your car, turning on the car, getting the AC running. By that time, you're already just like sweating buckets. And you've got like mud butt from, you know, drinking your coffee before, and you're like sweating everywhere. And so you get to work and like you need a shower, right? And you're like, okay, I could shower at the office. But then like when you go out for lunch, right, with your colleagues, it's like same exact thing again, sweating like crazy, feeling nasty. So it's almost like I know these dudes in Southeast Asia can pull it off. But like there is a cost to that. It's like constantly feeling like your underwear is soaking wet and you got sweat stains on your shirt, and it's a pretty grim experience to get those fades.
It was with the, because there's quite a few of them in the Indigo Invitational competition as well. And it was around the time of Ramadan where everyone was like, oh, I got to wash my jeans now because I can't wear these jeans to my family because I fucking stink, you know? It's like, well, yeah, probably should have washed them a few more times, but.
Stinky Boris.
Yeah.
Bit of a hot take, but I think I'm kind of coming more and more around to like not liking the Indigo Invitational, and also like the upcoming Patina Thunderdome for Stitchdown. I'm almost kind of like turning against these contests because it's like they almost like motivate you to destroy your garments for the purposes of like winning. Mm-hmm. Like I got in a bit of an argument, not argument, but I got told off by this dude on Facebook who. he's like, oh my god, my shirt stinks so fucking bad, I can't wear it. And I was like, dude, you can wash it. You'll still probably win the contest if you've got the right fades. He's like, what? Why would I wash it? My entire intention is to completely destroy this shirt and ruin it and make it as effed up as possible for the contest. And it's like, but I don't know. It's a weird one to me because it's almost like, yeah, sure, you can wear the hell out of your garment. You can try and destroy it, but then like. At the end of 1 year's time, you wasted $200, or unless you are happy with your expenditure for the purposes of destroying it. I don't know.
I think the thing is, like, everyone sees those fades of the, like, Malaysian dudes or, you know, all the Southeast Asians, and that's what everyone wants because they, most of the time, they'll win because of, you know, the sick fades that they get. But, like, if you live in a different climate and you just can't get to that, so people do, like, most ridiculous stuff with them, like not washing them for a year or, you know, things like that. I do agree with that, with you on that, to be honest. And I've really enjoyed like being part of the competition, but that's more from a community perspective, just like getting to know more people in this niche world that we live in. Not necessarily for, because I know I'm not going to win. Like, you know, I don't make a chance against any
believe
of them.
In
so, I believe, just not in this competition. Yeah. So for me, it's always just like the fun of like meeting new people and stuff like that. And yeah, so that's what it's all about for me. But yeah, you are correct. There's people in that competition who take things to the extreme. Like, absolutely.
I mean, if you really want to kind of get like a unique competitive advantage, you could always go find some like dusty Australian field with that kind of weird orange dirt you guys have there and just like roll around in the field for a while until your jeans have, it's kind of like ocean fades, right? But it's like Australian
Dirt
fades. Australia fades.
Australia, mate.
Jeans on the barbie.
And then back pocket, you have like a tinny fade.
Oh, Lord. Any other kind of topics you guys want to cover in the discussion, or should we do a couple Q&A before we wrap up?
Q&A.
All right. Some questions.
Anybody see something they'd like to grab off the board? Just
scroll through.
And the older ones are at the top, but yeah, they're all ones I think we haven't covered yet.
Why don't we do the question by Fashion is Therapy Yeg? that's the username. Craziest thing or place you've done, been while wearing denim, or even just a funny story / memory from this lifestyle. Yeah, I done the tallest peak in England.
Woo!
Woo! And I was so sweaty. But there was a pub right at the end, which I think is single-handedly the best, most refreshing pint I've ever had in my life.
I can imagine.
It was so worth it. And then, like, literally for like 6 days afterwards, my calves just killed me. It was so painful. I was just like, my muscles were like, oh yeah, yeah, we do things. And they didn't like it. But yeah, that's mine.
How long did it take, the walk? Or hike or whatever.
Yeah, I'd say it was good 3 to 4 hours, something like that. Right. So pretty decent. And we went up kind of the main touristy way, which I was quite thankful for. Because I think if we went up any of the other ways, I would have struggled. Especially like the way that we came down was like a scree slope that you just kind of have to surf across the stones to go down. There wasn't any sure foot in there at all. It was just like, whee! And I think everyone had a couple of bruises where they overestimated and slipped. So yeah, interesting.
Did you have other hiking gear on, or were you in like a full kind of heritage outfit? Like,
Farmer Tom. I had my pocket Henley on from Glad Hand, and I had my Red Wings with Vibram soles on, which, to be honest, I wasn't slipping at all on that mountain. Like, all the stones were fine, you know, going up. Everyone else in their kind of quote unquote walking boots, they were slipping all over the place. So well done, Red Wings, because they were great. I think, but yeah, I could probably do some other peaks. I'll do the three peaks in them. Which I won't, because I can't climb. Oh, and I'm also really scared of heights. So that was fun. But like on the way up, it was really cloudy. Like, it was just like grey everywhere. So that probably made it easier for me. But yeah, Lex, have you got any stories of your jeans?
I've also been climbing in jeans before. I went to Italy to do a type of climb called Via Ferrata. Have you guys heard of that? I think the translation, someone will probably correct me, is iron wire. And basically they do it in Italian Dolomites. And they just have this iron wire that goes up the mountain, and you just basically clip into it and climb up following it. So it's kind of like a version of rock climbing for people who don't really need to rock climb. So of course I did that a few years ago, wearing my raw denim shorts. Not long jeans, but raw denim shorts.
Skinny jeans.
Yeah. So I've done, yeah, climbing. Jorts, yeah. An inappropriate place to wear jeans. But other than that, nothing else really. You really need for this one Rudy, because he does everything in he's done everything that you can do in jeans. Probably a 2 pairs of them on at the same time.
Oh yes, I climbed the Alps in my jeans.
But anyone else?
Kind of a bit of a very different take on this question. So I remember when I bought my first raws, I bought a pair of APCs, and I'd never done raw denim before, and like I was kind of just getting into the hobby. And I remember I was like hanging out with a group of friends in San Francisco, like explaining the concept of raw denim and the fades. And I had a friend who, she worked in like biology, and like another friend who's a chemist, and a bunch of these kind of like science friends. And they basically just kind of had this one conversation about calculating how much like gross shit was on my jeans from living in San Francisco. So they were like calculating like homeless people pooping on the BART trains, and homeless people peeing like on park benches, and they were just kind of like sitting there this whole night at the bar, like calculating how much like horrible stuff was on my jeans. And I swear at one point I like almost had a panic attack just thinking about like how disgusting and horrible my denim was.
And the
I
fact was like, you've been sleeping in your bed with your jeans.
Well, not quite, but you know, you go home and you sit on your own sofa and all that stuff. And so I was like, all right, it basically convinced me to wash my jeans, and which is a good thing. But yeah, never go down that rabbit hole.
You could do it with anything in your life, though. It's like, ah, your shoes. Yes, you have been walking outside, and probably someone shat on the pavement there. You know, it's just a never-ending cycle at that point, and you would just end up like one of those weird people that scrubs their hands like 20 times a day.
That's why we've got an immune system.
Exactly. That's why I always go outside and lick the pavement.
Well, one of my friends started arguing how she's like, oh yeah, you could potentially get this rash on your skin from all the bacteria and this and this and that. And I'm just like, ah!
Potentially, you could walk out of your house and die. You know, there's always the potential.
San Francisco is so dirty too. But anyways.
So am I. Next question.
This is Tom.
Oh, Ilya, what have you got any stories?
Nothing crazy that I can think of. I've soaked a pair of, you know, fresh raws in the lake before.
I was about to say the lake.
That's probably
that looks pretty fun.
That's probably the craziest, if you can call that crazy. I did
have
that
you,
with.
Have you skipped for a field of wheat whilst wearing raw denim?
No, I haven't. No, so we, Sebastian and I, who used to attend our meetings and live in London, we were in Poland together, and we decided to do the soak at the same time with our warehouse jeans. So yeah, we jumped in and wore them for the rest of the kind of afternoon, letting them mold to our bodies. I did give them a wash afterwards, and you know, with soap and stuff like that, just to give them a nice clean. So yeah, that's probably the craziest bit I can relate to you guys about that.
Looks like I've been to the Taj Mahal in raw denim.
You're looking at all the places that you've been.
Cool. Somebody want to grab another question?
Yeah, let's do the top one. Has anyone had success using a tailor to take in the waste of a pair of jeans? It's an interesting question because
I haven't used a tailor, but I remember Black Horse Lane actually took in a pair, which I got from them. They took in the waste on my pair. And I think there's several ways you can do this. I think one option is to use a dart in the jeans. I think there's also ways where you can do it on the side of the denim. I assume Lex will probably be the best person to answer this.
Yeah, so I've done that before on a pair of chinos. I think I took it off the side seam, but it's a bit of a pain in the ass because, of course, the waistband's solid, so you need to essentially snip into the waistband, unpick the waistband, shorten the waistband, take a bit in off the trousers, and then re-sew it. So it's a bit of a faff. But with jeans, because it's got run and fell seams, there's kind of quite a lot going on the side seam because you've got the pocket there. So you can't take too much without changing the proportions of the pocket and just making it look a bit weird. So the only other option is then to take it off the center back where you've got the back rise, which is a run and fell seam. And again, you could do it, but you wouldn't be able to replace it with a chain stitch. You'd have to replace it with a lock stitch. Well, you might be able to do a chain stitch, but wouldn't be easy. So you could do it, but I just don't think it would look very good. So, I mean, the basic recommendation would be just buy jeans that fit.
Buy a different pair.
Or wear a belt.
Different size.
Or wear a belt. Or eat lots of pies until
it's
go to the pub a bit more often.
Yeah, so the way Black Horse does it is exactly as you mentioned, Lex. So it's like remove the center back belt loop, cut the waistband, unstitch the fell seam on the butt, pull in the fabric a bit, refell it, and then kind of sew the waistband behind the belt buckles. And when you sew, belt loops, and you put the belt loop back on, you in theory don't see it. And it does the trick, but I know it gives them real headaches to have to do that. And they don't like doing it because it's a pain in the ass. And I think the other issue too is like, you can't really change the front of the garment. So like the proportions are such that the front's still the same size, but the back's a bit smaller. So yeah.
Don't you lose the shape of the, because the shape will be different as well, right? Because I assume like the
it depends
shape
how
is
much.
All based on a size.
I think it depends how much you want to take in. If it's only like a centimeter or two, then it's not going to be that noticeable. If it's 2 inches, you're going to have, it's going to be completely different.
Yeah. Lex, you're on mute.
Oh, sorry, I'm on mute. I'm just, it changes the angle on the back rise as well. So it makes the back rise kind of more sloped, which gives you a more casual style. So it does change how they'd fit at the back. So yes, so basically I think the short answer is yes, it is possible, but I personally wouldn't recommend it unless it's a pair of jeans that you really love and you've got sentimental value, you know, you've had them for years and you've lost weight, maybe then, but otherwise it's...
Sell them.
You know, sell them. Sell them to a fatty.
Sell them or cinch them. Get some suspenders and a belt, you know, and cinch them
up.
There
we go.
I might suggest one. Buster the Human talked about favorite piece from your least worn clothing. I know in the board game hobby, we call it your shelf of shame. That's like board games you've bought that have just sat on your shelf and you haven't played them. Does anybody have like coat hanger of shame or shelf of shame of garments you haven't worn?
I mean, for me, but that's mainly because of the climate, is my 316 denim jacket. Because, like, I don't really get the opportunity to wear it that much. I would love to have worn it a lot more because I've had it for, like, 3 or 4 years now, I think. Probably 3 years. And it barely has a crack in it, you know. I've worn it a few times, but not too much. So... I'm looking forward to whenever we move back to Europe to start wearing it a bit more often. But yeah, that's purely because I can't really wear it over here.
I've got a bit of a weird one in that, like, while working at home, I haven't adopted like working in a hoodie and track pants. Like, I still wear jeans and shirts and stuff every day, as if I was going out in the real world. So like from a jeans and shirts and all that kind of stuff standpoint, I'm getting a lot of wear on my garments. But the weird one for me is I'd call it shoes of shame because I don't really go out all that much. So like I'm almost never putting a pair of boots on or a pair of shoes on. So like my shoes are just sitting there collecting dust.
Yeah, I've got quite a few because obviously I wear my United Overalls jeans to fade them as sickly as possible. I do still kind of have a saw Kevin like so I've got like a nice pile of like some nice LVC jeans, some like 1880 overalls and stuff. There's a nice one in brown duck canvas which I got on eBay, some nice Lee archive bits, and you know, bits that I just don't have the time for. Occasionally, like, if I then like soak or wash my jeans on the day of drying, then I'll get one of these out and be like, yay, I can wear them, woo. But yeah, it rarely happens, so that's my part of the shame.
I think my one would be, I've just brought it out to show you guys, it's my old blue co work jacket, which they call a type 3, which I don't know why they called it. It's like a it's more like a type 1.
Not type 3 in the slightest.
Exactly. It's got like a Lee-esque front pocket and you've got a cinch back. So it's indigo plaid. It's a beautiful fabric. Just haven't worn it enough. And it's still pretty crispy. So this is the one which I feel probably most ashamed of because I think it deserves more wear. I think it's the same fabric that Rising Sun were using on their version, which is quite similar.
Is that not a gingham?
Well, they call it indigo plaid.
Yeah.
They call it indigo plaid. I don't know whether you can.
Ah, yeah, okay, yeah.
It's similar. Yeah, I've got a shirt by Monsieur Ace Co. that's got a similar fabric that was like a dead stock from the 30s. which is pretty cool. So like very, very similar check.
Yeah. So that's probably my piece, and I'll have to start wearing it a little bit more.
Yeah, I've got my US Wabash shirt, which I bought last year, which is a great shirt, but I never really wear because I don't really know what to wear it with. Because I think it probably looks better with like tan trousers, but I only ever really wear jeans, so it kind of sits there in the cupboard, which is a bit of a shame. And also, I think it will look better once it's worn, you know, when they look really worn and bashed, but then I'm not wearing it enough to make it look worn and bashed, so it's a bit of a catch 22.
Yeah, maybe you could wash it a couple of times when you're, you know, washing other things.
Yeah,
just to give it. But I usually wear my Wabash with jeans.
I think
I've got the same shirt.
Probably all got the same shirt.
is it the one that's got like the one pocket on one side, and on the other side it's got kind of like a pen pocket and a standard pocket? Yep. I think it's got like railway something across
the
back.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. That's the one.
I've got the chambray version of that shirt.
I've had mine for probably like 4 or 5 years now, and it breaks in real nice and it fades really nice. I think also Junior from Rivet and Hyde has that same shirt. So if you see, I can send you some pictures, or if you look on their Insta, it breaks in really good. I think if you've got like a pair of dark indigo, it goes quite nice with that.
Yeah, I think that's it, because I've just made myself a pair of jeans recently, so I'll start one with dark indigo, I think, this winter. But I'd also take that question a different way. Do you guys have any? So, as I mentioned, I'm moving house. So at the weekend, I was down at my parents sorting out all my stuff that's in storage, and I found some of my like items of clothes that I bought years ago before I got into this scene and before I started wearing this sort of clothes. And I've got quite a few items that I would never ever even consider wearing these days, but there's a little bit part of me that can't quite bring myself to throw them out, because it was something that I loved, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago. Like, so just some, oh, like I had a really ugly old leather jacket that I bought as a student, which I used to love when I was a student, but nowadays it's so ugly, some like DKNY thing. Do you guys have any items like that still that you're still clinging on to from the pre-denim days?
Yeah, I do. I've got a few bits. I've managed to move most of that stuff and donate it or give it to people that, you know, that I wanted to. But there are a few bits. I've got a few football shirts, for example, which are, you know, I wouldn't wear, but they have a lot of sentimental value to me because they were, you know, given to me usually for my birthday or Christmas by my parents at the time. And yeah, just those kind of things I haven't let go of. Everything else I've pretty much been able to release. So what about you guys? Anyone else?
I would say move countries if you want to get rid of stuff.
I think I like to mix in a bit of pre-denim style into my clothes. So like I still like to wear, you know, some Nikes here and there, or like some Vans, kind of stuff from like more of my like streetwear or kind of skater days. I like to kind of mix that in a bit with my raw denim, and not, because I don't like feeling like I'm wearing too much of a specific uniform. Like I don't want to look like I'm playing the part. So like mixing in a bit of streetwear, or like even stuff like, you know, mixing in a bit of like outdoor kit, whether it's like, you know, my Arc'teryx shell or stuff like that. So I don't know. I like to
Gorp core.
Yeah. Gorp streetwear / Gorp core, or like old hip hop tees. You also kind of wear those here and there. So I don't know. I kind of like to hang on to some of those old things, because I've often found that like stuff that at one point I didn't want and I sold, I sometimes still regret. Like at one point I had this Stephen Allen collaboration with a continuous lean that was like a super, super, super heavyweight black Oxford cloth button down, like OCBD. And I sold it because it was a bit boxy and didn't feel kind of like fitted enough. And, you know, now I would totally wear it and it'd be awesome, but it's gone and I can never replace it.
Yeah, I've got a few bits that I kind of keep from my just mainstream Levi's days. It's like a few of that kind of stuff. And most of the stuff that I give to my younger brother, because he's similar size to me. He's like a foot taller than me. He's ridiculous. He's lanky git. But yeah, usually I just give my bits to him. And I'm like, oh yeah, shit, I remember those jeans. Yeah, they don't fit me anymore. I might give him my samurais, actually, because they're like just way too small on the waist for me. And he might appreciate 24 ounce. Who knows? I might convert him. Let's hope.
Plant the seed.
Get him onto it.
I've got one, but it might be quite a quick one here from MXN Boots Boy. Have you ever tried bleaching jeans? No,
but I have seen this recently. I think CDC, the chap who runs the blog.
Yeah.
He's based. So he was talking about this. So I, from my understanding, the reason why this has become quite popular is to try and get more contrast on your fades.
Mm.
So you mix in a little bit of the bleach when you're soaking your jeans, with the hope of the more faded parts will become whiter, and you'll get that more of a contrast. I believe this is the reasoning for it. But no, I haven't tried this, and I don't plan on using it, because I don't think, I'm just, why add bleach to this? It'll just wash your jeans as you do with other clothes, and they'll be good.
Yeah, you're damaging the fibers at the end of the day. Like,
yeah.
Think of it like hair. Don't bleach your hair.
I think for me, like, I hate using bleach anyways, because it's like so nasty and chemical. Like, even when I have to like clean the house with it, it's like, man, I wish I had like something that's like not so toxic and caustic horribleness. So like, I don't know, I almost like just wouldn't want to do it, even just because it's such a nasty thing to work with anyways, and you're sending it down the drain afterwards. So like, for me, it's almost like, just conceptually, I would never go near that.
Maybe we should try like apple cider vinegar fades or something. And then you'll smell like a fish and chip shop afterwards.
Oh man, apple cider vinegar is the jam though. Or actually, like, more like the industrial vinegar, malt vinegar is the jam for like, if you ever need to get like something horrible out of your jeans. It's like, if they go moldy, if they go damp, if they go anything, it's like, throw that sucker in the washing machine with a cup of vinegar and it's like magic. I even use it for hair shampoo.
And like, isn't baking soda meant to be really good as well? Isn't that?
Yeah.
One? Yeah. So yeah. Like vinegar and baking soda. They're like.
There's some like kind of hippie home blogs that argue that like you could do anything in your entire home kind of cleaning and maintenance wise with like just baking soda or vinegar. Not sure how legit that is, but it's, those two are miracle products.
Maybe we should run a live trial or wash our jeans with different home remedy versions.
People say do all kinds of crazy shit with mayonnaise. Anyone want to sign up for mayonnaising your jeans?
Isn't that when you have gum in your hair?
Seriously, it's like, there's a whole bunch of weird junk that's like, oh, you can fix that with mayonnaise.
Do they just really like eating mayonnaise? They're like, oh, yeah, it's mayonnaise.
I challenge someone in America, which is, this is kind of a joke, making fun of American culture, but to try ranch dressing fades. See what happens if you wash your jeans with ranch dressing. That shit's worse than bleach, man. I hate ranch dressing.
Coca-Cola. Get all that rust Mentos out of your,
there while you're at it. Coke and Mento fades.
He's so brown afterwards.
Oh, here you go. Someone in the UK needs to see what happens if you wash your jeans in brown sauce.
Or maybe do like Scottish fades and do Urn Brew, then you get that nice
orange
weft.
Yeah.
Urn Brew.
Jeans battered up.
Yeah.
Do one in Lucozade, then you get like cobalt blue as well.
You get some Urn Brew and mix that in with that red orange Australian dirt. You have some crazy looking jeans. Actually, you probably have jeans that look like the ones that Okuyama Denim was trying to flog with the kind of like burgundy brownish weft.
was that the wine ones you're thinking about, or the Kakashima ones?
One of the, or kind of both. They were quite similar, but though I make jokes about it. They're actually pretty cool looking jeans. So
going back to the main discussion topic, I think you probably will see a lot more. What am I looking to say?
Maybe experiments.
Maybe using more natural dyes. For jeans. So like you've seen the trend recently with Kakashiba, for example, a lot more jeans being brown, the weft being used. So you might see things like that. And I know other brands have used it.
Indigo generally, like, chemically is pretty horrific to dye with. Yeah. I hand dyed something at home and it was just like, oh, the whole pot smelled like farts for ages. It was grim.
Yeah, to Ilya's point, I have really enjoyed those tanukis I got in the regular straight fit, which is, I think, much more of like a high-rise kind of relaxed fit that you guys would appreciate. Yeah. But the weft is dyed with like pomegranate, and somehow it turns out kind of olive green. So yeah, I think those kind of interesting, weird, natural dyes are quite a cool space to explore, and I definitely would buy more jeans that have kind of, like they did those ones with the black beans that kind of came out that kind of smoky grayish-blue. I definitely like to see more of those kind of cool natural dyes.
And how are you liking the cut?
You know, it keeps growing on me bit by bit. I mean, because it's like a 12-inch front rise and I usually go for like an 11, it feels a bit kind of annoying that I have to like make sure the jean stays at my waist. Otherwise, I end up getting a bit of like a drop crotch look. So I have to be really particular about like making sure my belt's on the right notch, making sure it's at the right height. The
suspenders,
legs are.
Mate.
I can't do that. I can't do that.
Neon fifth element.
Still couldn't do that. I wore suspenders once in my life, and it was for like a Clockwork Orange Halloween costume. Nice. But yeah, still a little bit baggier than I'd like in the legs, but like with the right shoe, the right shirt. It gives me options, I guess, is what it ultimately boils down to. Like if I want, they're actually my favorite working at home jeans just because they're more relaxed and more comfortable to sit in. Although these days I do standing desk, but yeah, no, they're cool. I like the fact I've got variety. I'd even probably buy a second pair of jeans in that same cut, I think. Yeah, I think I would.
So we just need to get Kevin to try something a little bit wider.
Maybe one day. Who knows?
Never say never.
Exactly. Never say never.
I think the key selling point for me on those jeans is that like there's never any situation where I feel like I'm getting pinched somewhere. Like in my slim straight jeans, good. It's like if I sit the wrong angle, it's like it's busting my balls, or if I if I cross my legs, the back of my knees are getting squashed. So I think the key thing about these kind of more relaxed cuts is like you never feel like you're in a compromising position and the garment is like chafing you. Because like
a week shot to the OnlyFans section now.
Oh man.
Yes, we have.
Well, I guess we've maybe jumped the shark by this point. Cool. I guess.
And on that note,
I also just like really badly got to hit the toilet. So that's why I'm like doing jumping jacks while we're recording.
So you want to do another question then, David?
No.
Here's a question for you. Number one or number two?
two.
Oh, shit. I've lost all composure here. Poop jokes always. Yeah, on that note. Cool. So everybody, thanks again for listening to episode 13, my lucky number. Please rate and review us wherever you listen to our podcasts. Please also follow us on Instagram at Sons of Selvage Podcast. Lastly, please message us on Instagram with any questions you'd like us to discuss. So far, we've really enjoyed all the questions that folks have sent in. And please reach out if you're keen to join us on Discord. And on that note, see you next month.
Future.